This sounds surreal, but what we have is our organization often having to go out onto social media and go, I need an oncologist, I need an ophthalmologist, I need an endocrinologist. I've had to triage. I'm a lawyer, not a doctor. Men on the phone who are in the middle of a minor heart attack and trying to calm them down while I find a specialist to get on the phone. That's insane. And that's what's happening right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. This week, medical transfers. This issue has dominated federal politics this week, and if the coalition has its way, border protection will dominate the election discussion. My guests, the independent Karen Phelps and the CEO of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, Kon Karapatiotitis. There's some disturbing content ahead in this conversation, but these are stories we need to listen to. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming into the studio. I really appreciate it.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Karen, we're going to start with you. So we've been through this whole, well, kind of bizarre 72 hours in Canberra, which has now resulted in the passage of the Medical Evacuations Bill. I'm conscious that there is still a lot of hyperbole, misinformation, politicking going around about this proposal. So why don't we just start with basic facts? What does it do?
The Medical Evacuations Bill does exactly what it says. It fast-tracks medical evacuations based on medical need and not on the ability of somebody to run a case through court, sometimes for years, before they get the medical attention that they need. Now, this has arisen out of doctors and other health practitioners on Manus Island and Nauru saying for quite some time, you know, 5 years, that it's been a cumbersome and obstructive process and very distressing for them not to be able to get people transferred without having to go through a whole lot of unnecessary legal obstructions and for no other reason other than to delay the medical transfer. Now, in every single case of the hundreds of cases that have been run through the courts, in every single case, the doctor's decision has been upheld. And so what this seeks to do is to put the decisions about medical transfers substantially in the hands of doctors, but with adequate ministerial oversight.
And that gets sort of to the crux of the politicking, doesn't it? So let's be very clear about that. Obviously, this new regime, as you say, puts clinicians sort of at the front of the queue in terms of making assessments about whether or not someone needs to be transferred on medical grounds. But the Home Affairs Minister does have discretion to prevent medical transfers as well. So what's the discretion?
Okay. Once a doctor on Manus or Nauru says, we cannot cope with this case because we don't have either the resources or the expertise to deal with the case, and obviously you can't provide every investigative piece of equipment, you can't provide every specialist in a given field with the equipment that they would need to deal with something like, for example, a kidney stone. Incredibly painful condition, and it needs a particular type of machinery to investigate it and to treat it. So that's just one example, and there are many. And the longer that people are there, the worse they get. And so what this seeks to do is to say, okay, that doctor can't cope. Let's get advice from a specialist in Australia who deals in this issue. They will either give advice to that doctor about how to deal with the situation, or they'll say, no, I agree, this person needs to be transferred. That decision then goes to the minister, and then the minister has time, several days, to make a decision about whether they agree or not on medical grounds.
Yep.
If they don't agree on medical grounds, it then goes to a medical panel, and the medical panel then advises the minister that they think the original advice was correct. If, on the other hand, the minister looks at this case and says, I have advice that on national security grounds, there's a problem with this particular transfer, then the transfer doesn't happen. And there is, then it's the patient does not get transferred to Australia under this legislation.
There's criminality as well.
Yes.
There's that other criteria.
Yes.
Well.
Well, that was something that was a matter of quite intense discussion yesterday, and getting the words right on that. But bearing in mind that these people would be in detention when they came to Australia, if necessary, they could be under high security, getting the medical care they needed, just like prisoners are here in Australia, but given the concerns about that, the minister's discretion and veto power on character grounds was inserted into the bill, and so that exists. So it's intensely frustrating when you're sitting in question time and you're hearing members of the government get up and say that, you know, criminals are going to be flooding into the country. Well, that's covered off in this legislation. That was anticipated, and moves were made with the legislation to get the wording right so that there was ministerial veto for criminality.
Just before we bring Con into this discussion, you said obviously that veto power, for want of a better word, around criminality was the subject of fairly intense discussion around the place, because Labor wanted that inserted into the bill that was passed in the Senate last year. So give us a little bit of that discussion in terms of what your concerns were in relation to adding that extra dimension of ministerial discretion. Was it that if you frame it too widely, then the minister sort of has an open ambit, really, to say,
Where we are now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like the cut of that guy's jib or whatever.
Well, they protested out the front of Manus Island Detention Centre, so they've got bad character. Or they got on a boat to come to Australia, so they've got a bad character.
Yeah.
And so it was being applied way too widely. So there was a real reluctance to give away too much on the character score and to confine it to criminality.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was, you know, there were people who were also arguing for the fact that if somebody has committed a crime, they are no less deserving of humanitarian medical care on a temporary basis than anybody else. And we provide that care in the jails here in Australia all the time.
Oh, well, you're a doctor, you would say that.
Well, I do have to put the medical point of view because that's my frame of reference.
Con, tell us about why we're at this juncture. Because let's just say you have sort of been involved in pretty much every iteration of the story to date, which is the story of medical transfers of people from Manus and Nauru, often through contested court processes, etc. Now, a lot of people don't follow this closely. So how about we explain what's gone on there?
So my organisation, the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, for the last 5 years, and the last 5 years when Manus and Nauru was first opened, has spent the last 5 years trying to get critically ill people medically transferred. And why today was needed, why this bill was needed, was in the past, we had children stopping eating, walking, talking in comatose-like states. We had babies as young as 6 months, 2 years old, at risk. We had 7-year-olds trying to slash their throats, 9, 10, 11-year-olds trying to hang themselves and cut their faces with glass. Now, this is graphic, but this is what was happening to children. In any other situation, you would evacuate these kids. And guess what the ASRC had to do? We had to go to court for every single one of these children. In fact, while our Prime Minister claims he got all kids off Nauru, 80% came through legal court orders or legal action.
I'll stop you there. Did the Commonwealth, in every one of those cases, did the Commonwealth oppose the transfer, the application for transfer?
In almost all of those cases, they did. And the only time they started to soften was when the Kids Off Nauru campaign got enough legs to it. And when that launched in August and suddenly the nation's attention was on it, we started to see more people, more cases where there was concessions. But those concessions, you have to understand this, we only ever get lawyers involved after the informal request for action is ignored. So legal action is the last resort, not the first resort.
Let's do just again, assuming that people are not intimately watching all of these developments, right? So you've described a sort of set of catastrophic circumstances in terms of people's physical health, well-being,
mental health. To this day.
Right. But tell people about the process on Manus Island, on Nauru, how are these people managed in situ? How does it work? Yeah. Like, let's set aside the legislation for now. How does it work this second, as of now?
So having been to Manus Island myself, having actually been there and seen it firsthand just over a year ago, what I saw actually horrified me, which is on Manus Island, there are no mental health services. There are medical services that are incredibly limited. So that is the equipment you need for some of the most basic things. Like at the moment, I'm on the phone with men on Manus that are possibly going permanently blind who might be having organ failure, and they can actually get the basic test done to see whether, in fact, that's about to happen. So the equipment isn't there. They're having to pay for their own medicines. These are men who are destitute. Doctors are almost never available. I know you're hearing our Prime Minister talk about there are more doctors available on Nauru, for example, than per head of population in Australia. And I keep quoting 60. There are actually only 15 at any one time, and they're on shifts, which literally means the windows a couple of hours a day for hundreds and hundreds of desperate and sick people. So in fact, that's also a first. So what we have now, we don't have the equipment in place, we don't have the medical access in place. Most of the medications that men need, for example, on Manus, aren't even available at the local pharmacy. So what we have, and this sounds surreal, but what we have is our organization often having to go out onto social media and go, I need an oncologist, I need an ophthalmologist, I need an endocrinologist. I've had to triage, I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, men on the phone who are in the middle of a minor heart attack and trying to calm them down while I find a specialist to get on the phone. That's insane. And that's what's happening right now.
So how do you think the codifying how medical transfers proceed, which is in essence, if we sort of cut through what this legislation does, how will that assist? How will that provide a better practice?
So one of the things we did, we currently are actively, we have 70 high-risk cases of people at imminent risk of death or serious medical harm, and another 215 on our waiting list that we've been desperately trying to get to. And we did an audit of these cases. You know, that is, what are their conditions? When were they recommended for transfer? We took our 70 worst cases. And what we found was all of them had been waiting between 2 to 5 years for medical transfer after a recommendation from the government's own contracted doctors, which previously was IHMS. So what we found was a pattern of extraordinary systemic neglect. And the difference is here, subject to character test, Section 501, Subsection 7 of the Migration Act, what people are held to here in this country, and the ASIO Act of 1979, there are very robust protections in place around that. Also worth noting, the minister couldn't name on Lee Sale's show last night a single, wouldn't give a number on how many people would even file the character test, because as far as I know, there are none that have got any such conviction. Important to remember that. We're talking about innocent human beings and refugees here. That what it does is a process that dragged that for 2 to 5 years, suddenly there are 7 days, unless there are security or character concerns. So suddenly what happens is, God forbid, we actually follow the orders of doctors like we do in any other situation. And it's extraordinary to see the attack on the integrity of our medical profession. Doctors are the most trusted profession in this country. Politicians are the least trusted. So if you're asking the Australian public which side they're going to choose the doctors. And it's really important for you to know that when we make these medical assessments, we bring specialists in. This work often takes months. We FOI medical files. We get second opinions. This is a slow, arduous, thorough, forensic process to try to assess people's cases. In contrast to the way in which the Prime Minister's talking about it, with total disrespect to our medical profession, their standards and their integrity and their professionalism. And we've been doing the work for 5 years. We do the majority of the work that he's talking about. And we know the care and time and effort and care. We can't afford for this system to fail. Like, we need to make sure it has integrity. And we need to make sure that people's cases we're putting forward are compelling and meet the threshold. But this legislation is about saving lives, and we've had 12 people die, and this is about stopping any more deaths. That's what it's about. Since when did we become a nation that thinks we're a safer nation when we leave people to die, for God's sake?
I want to ask you, Karen, just picking up on something that Con said in terms of disrespect for the medical profession, I want to frame that slightly differently. One of the a legitimate issue, I think, in passing this law, in setting these boundaries, and this is, I want to ask you because now you wear both hats. There is a legitimate issue, I think, in trading off professional expertise of doctors and clinicians versus the responsibility in a representative democracy for politicians to own these decisions, for them to be accountable for these decisions. Did that cause you any grief now that you wear two hats? See, when you're a doctor, you say, a doctor, you know, as Con says, we just follow normal medical procedures, right? Your doctor says, you have X condition, here's your medicine, take your medicine. People do it, right? People don't think, oh, someone else should tell me what to do or someone else knows better, right? But now you're a parliamentarian and you are responsible for a set of decisions that you help to create in terms of lawmaking and other things. Do you think there's a genuine conundrum there, or do you think it's a bit overblown?
No, I don't think there's a conundrum at all because, you know, if you go back to my years as the AMA president, I'm very well aware that the decisions doctors make have national and sometimes international repercussions. And so, you know, when as the AMA president, I put forward an idea for something for the health system, we had to have that fully budgeted and analysed. So I'm very well aware of that process. I'm also very well aware of the political processes that need to go into place in order for legislation to become law and also for that law to become a reality in practice. And so I don't think you can ever go too far wrong doing the right thing. And I think it's important that you also bear in mind that in doing the right thing, you need to have a practical approach to how you go about achieving that. And so in everything that I do, I don't just say this is a problem. I come up with a solution. I seek expert advice on a range of topics, whether it's, you know, medical, whether it's about the environment, whether it's about the political ramifications, whether it's about the cost, and those are all of the inputs into that decision making. But one of the things I would add to the concerns that have been raised about this legislation is that it refers only to the current cohort of people on Manus Island and Nauru. So to say that this is going to become this wonderfully attractive prospect for people to get on a boat, to get lost at sea, to go to Manus Island, to become so desperately ill that they come temporarily to Australia only to not be able to resettle here permanently, that it only applies to the people who are currently on Manus Island and Nauru, and I don't see how that provides any kind of attraction at all.
What do you think about Scott Morrison's disposition over the last 48 hours in particular in terms of signalling to people smugglers, which is sort of what Labor's saying, by reopening the Christmas Island Detention Centre, by saying that Parliament has weakened the border protection regime? Both of you, what do you guys think of that?
I just was following an ABC journalist who's in Indonesia at the moment, and he just said the Medivac bill passed without a blimp, as in people had no interest in it. But what's caught people's attention is our Prime Minister banging on about opening up Christmas Island again. So the only person in Parliament right now that is actually trying to encourage people to get back onto boats is our Prime Minister and Peter Dutton. Everyone else, the ALP and the rest of the crossbench, they're busy getting the job of governing done and actually passing bills that are going to stop more deaths. It's quite extraordinary to see a rhetoric and a language where he's actually encouraging people to get onto boats simply to fulfill an empty, baseless, fear-mongering narrative. I'm actually deeply disturbed and disgusted. And to watch in the Senate today to be accusing the men on Manus of all sorts of heinous things with no evidence, with no facts, with no convictions, I'm beyond appalled, actually. This is gutter politics at its worst, but the story of today is actually politics at its finest and actually seeing this incredible coalition of compassion and decency that actually won the day. And that's the bloody story today. He's actually listening to the changing tide in the community where we are sick of this fear-mongering. We've been having it since the days of the Tampa. We're done. The Australian public is exhausted with persecuting and punishing and hurting these poor defenceless people that are simply, the only thing they've done is simply come to our shores seeking our protection. And all this bill does today is say, a great nation like ours shouldn't leave people to die. A great nation like ours, when a refugee is sick, should make sure they get basic medical care. The fact that this even requires a bill and the fact that this requires this controversy in itself hurts my soul. And this government could have been on the side of history, on the right side today. And instead, what they're sitting there and doing is appealing to the worst in us. And those days are done. The country can see through that. And all I'm getting from the nation is just euphoria and joy that finally the politics of compassion and actual leadership have triumphed for once.
Karen, in Wentworth, do you think these days are done? Are you perfectly confident? You're obviously a parliamentarian now heading into a re-election period. Are you absolutely tranquil about the decision that you've made? And do you think your constituents in Wentworth think this is the right thing to do?
I've said many occasions that I represent the sensible centre, and in any electorate, you'll get views from the one side to the other. But the majority of people in Wentworth wanted me to stand up for getting kids off Nauru, and I did that. And the majority of people wanted more humane treatment for asylum seekers, and that is what this legislation represents. So I have delivered what I gave an undertaking to my electorate to do. So it will be up to them how they want to be represented.
If you lose your seat, will it have been worth it?
You might have to ask the refugees who are desperately needing medical care and the children who can face a new life. But certainly for those people, this has been absolutely worth it. And I have a lot more to offer the Australian Parliament, and we'll just have to see whether the electorate of Wentworth agrees.
Enough of the grubby politics. Just one last question.
I would just like to acknowledge also just Dr. Phelps' role in this and just how important her role in this was, and actually using her political capital for someone who's just joined to actually take the stand. I just think that in itself was a lightning rod. And I'm just thinking people are hungry for that. They're actually hungry for positive leadership. That's what we need right now.
No, well, indeed, a lot of political capital has been invested in it. That is absolutely right. Let's get out of the grubby politics because, it is your job. Just one more question, just of a sort of substantive nature. Do you think now that the procedures are codified that there is any risk of an intensification of despair in these places? Now, I'm not saying that people, I'm not suggesting that people put on mental health conditions. Yeah. Obviously, that would be a ridiculous thing to say. But now there are a set of procedures. Everybody knows what they are. Do you think that there are any risks that this system will be played?
You know what's so desperately sad is this. All the people we're working with at the moment, their medical files are folio upon folio upon folio, 2014, 15, 16, 17. All the people I'm talking about have medical conditions that have been spanning years. In fact, the opposite is happening. We're actually going to see less people trying to self-harm. I'm already hearing from the mental manners that it's giving them hope to hold on. We're actually going to see the opposite. I can't stress to you enough how horrific these conditions are and how traumatized and broken so many people are. You can't put that on. And the role of the specialist that we'll be working with is to properly assess this and to make sure that people meet this threshold. But I've got to get back to the fact that the medical conditions I'm talking about span years, many of them up to 5 years. You can't fake blind. You can't fake kidney failure. You can't fake... Yeah, I need to get this across because it's really important, this notion that suddenly people are going to start gaming something. These people have been in prison for 5 years, and the reality is the poor state of health is endemic, and it's an epidemic on Manus and Nauru because this government had 5 years to get this right. And they had 5 years to resettle these people. I can speak now as a human rights lawyer here. They had 5 years to resettle these people. They had 5 years to prevent this moment. This wouldn't have been needed if they hadn't abrogated their duty of care, both medically and morally and legally. And that's why we're where we are. So put that burner on the government about how the hell did we have to get to this point, and how the hell did it take 5 years, and how the hell did it take 12 deaths and hundreds of suicide attempts and hundreds of damaged children, some of which will never, ever recover from the trauma that they've gone through. And I see them now. They're broken. So many of these children are broken forever. That's the bloody story here.
I think we couldn't end on a stronger note.
I agree.
Let's end there.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. Do remember the drill, subscribe and share if you like the listening. Please do tell your friends. Thanks as always to Miles Martignoni and to Hannah Izzard for production. See you next week.